come up and I wanted a Grover. I wanted to ask you guys a question here because I'm not finding some of the information of what I thought I asked for in this packet. And the question I wanted to know was, as I remember, this particular hearing did not refer, our section of, did not refer to eyeglasses or anything like that. It was strictly to the incontinence supplies. And there was some special instructions of all the things it was going to do just to, in that area. We didn't, we had this overall information on the other issues in the packet, but they were not even discussed at that particular hearing. As we left the hearing, it went on into other sections that affected other areas, and there was some special material handed out there, as I recall, that spoke directly to the incontinence supplies and what that would do to the providers and what that would do to the bill. And that portion of it, as I saw, was a 93, it was, I recall, 93,000 with $1.9 million or something like that impact on the small industry. And it also went ahead and said what they would have to do in order to assure that all those things got done. And I don't find that in here. I find just the overall suggestion of what the committee did, but not the instructions to that particular section of the hearing. Am I right or am I...
Mr. Chair, are you referring to the last hearing that we had here or the original hearing on this subject, or rather the meeting on this subject that was over at SDSD?
The meeting on this subject at SDSD that Senator Mesderly and I attended.
Well, for the record, Mr. Chair, Grover Simmons, representing adult foster homes, your recollection is accurate. And those two numbers are the only numbers that were put on the table at that meeting. To my understanding, it was the $93,000 potential savings and the loss of $1.9 million to the suppliers and the vendors if that were adopted, and the offer by the suppliers to reduce the cost of the product by 5% if necessary to offset this $93,000. And that was the not only the thrust, that was the entire meeting at SDSD, which was the first meeting on the subject. And the future, the subsequent information relating to fiscal impact all was developed way down the line for this most recent meeting you had here a week or so ago. But that was not available to us at the time of the meeting at SDSD where the two of you testified.
Well, I'm a bit frustrated by this whole process, and I'm not trying to be unreasonable to be in a cost-saving process, but I am very disappointed with the lack of willingness, what I feel is lack of willingness to work with an industry, what I consider to be a lack of consideration of very outlying people that are in our outlying areas, the rural areas that are going to be affected by this, and the burden that it puts on the individual operating a small adult foster home or something like that, where they have to step in and at great expense and great problems to themselves, fill in for when government is saying that they want all the benefit of the simplicity on their side. And so I'm having a problem ignoring exactly where to go here. We didn't have a chance to review this information before we got the packet here, and apologize for that. But
Mr. Chairman, Tom has a point expressly on the eyeglass.
Go ahead. Senator Fisher, for the record, Tom Holt, the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. The -2 amendments exclude eyeglasses and hearing aids, which should reduce significantly the original fiscal impact.
I think what I'm going to go ahead and attempt to do is to, if the committee wills, is to go ahead and add these proposed Dash Two amendments to the bill and send it to Ways and Means and try to sort things out through the Ways and Means process and see what we can do, but at least we'll have a feel for there.
Thank you.
We are in work session. I would entertain a motion for the Dash Two amendment, Bill 567.
Mr. Chairman, I have...
Senator Carter.
Move the Dash Two amendments on Senate Bill 567.
Senator Carter moves the Dash Two amendments on Senate Bill 567. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Move 567 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Ways and Means, excuse me. Ways and Means. With a due pass.
Senator Carter moves Senate Bill 567 as amended by the Dash Two amendments to the Ways and Means Committee. Further discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, will clerk call the roll?
Senator Mike Lewis?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Hillary?
Aye.
Senator Hager?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye, and measure carries, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 567 and open a work session on Senate Bill 9. Yes, go ahead.
Senate Bill 9 establishes patient prescription drug assistance program at the Oregon State University College of Pharmacy, requires the program to assist low-income patients in applying for free or discontinued medications from pharmaceutical companies. It requires the program to provide information to patients, physicians, and others about free discount drug service, and requires the program to increase public awareness of free discount prescriptions. Requires the program to establish a toll-free hotline, internet website, and declares the emergency effective July 1, 2001. We do have amendments to this attached to our Dash 1 amendments and an engrossed copy of those amendments. The Dash 1 amendments primarily require the program to provide information on eligibility, coverage, and process of applying for publicly funded programs, and requires the program to assist patients if the person is not eligible for any publicly funded prescription drug program. This does have a fiscal impact of approximately $500,000.
Tom, the Jewish to weigh in on. That's fine. Go ahead, and I've understood we had some Dash 2 amendments along with the Dash 1 amendments, and I wish to weigh in on that.
Oh. Yes, Chair Fisher, and members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. With me here is Wayne Cragin, with the Dean of the Oregon State University School of Pharmacy, and he can speak to the original bill, I think, and the Dash 1 amendments, which, you know, in our view from the profession is this would be a good bill with the Dash 1s, which are technical changes. This will assist people to gain access to private sector programs that already exist for people in need to get heavily subsidized or even free access to medications directly from the pharmaceutical companies, and I'll be glad to speak to the Dash 2s when it's your pleasure.
Okay. Senator Fisher, again, as Tom has said, I'm Wayne Cratch, and I'm the Dean of the Oregon State University College of Pharmacy. I testified previously on this bill when it was first referred amongst, to this committee, and I just want to reiterate my support for an endorsement of this bill. It is a well-crafted, it's designed after a summer program from University of Rhode Island, and I think there's a lot we can learn from theirs and be able to get this started relatively easily. But I share Tom's concerns over the Dash 2 amendment.
Just having had a chance to briefly eyeball the Dash 2 amendments, it appears that that would be an attempt to put Senate Bill 876 into Senate Bill 9.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I want my apologies, but because of the 24-hour rule, I didn't have a chance to discuss this with you, but wanted to offer a friendly amendment to Senate Bill 9 at the time appropriate. We can have Connie to come up and explain the new amendments.
That's fine. We'll take the time. Who did you want to come?
Connie.
Connie?
Yeah. Mr. Chair on this side.
Chair Fisher and committee, for the record, I'm Connie Seeley, Legislative Director with the Senate Democratic Office. Senator Fisher, you have it absolutely correct. The Dash 2s put Senate Bill 876 into Senate Bill 9. Just for some clarification, because Senate Bill 9 was scheduled somewhat late yesterday, but obviously within the 24-hour rule, we couldn't get brand new amendments drafted. Ledge Council now needs 2 days to draft amendments. So, just for clarification.
Would you talk about the effects of the Dash 2?
Sure. The Dash 2s simply say that pharmacies have to sell prescriptions to Medicare eligibles at Medicaid prices. And you've had a full hearing on this bill several weeks ago.
And in a time of problems with human resource budgets and things the way they are, nobody's told me where the money's come for this.
Well,
except out of the pharmacist's pocket.
Right. And there is another sheet.
Not right, it's come out of the pharmacist.
Well, no one has told you. We have proposed a dispensing fee, which is taken directly actually from the state of California, that would help offset the impact to pharmacies.
And where does that money come from? Certainly not the state of California.
No, it doesn't. And actually, Chair, if I may, I have a sheet. And let me apologize for the roughness of this. This is a little unexpected and kind of thrown together. So, as you may or may remember or not, the fiscal impact to 876 is $500,000 in one-time startup costs, $200,000 in operational costs. My understanding is that the $200,000 is an 11-cent per transaction admin cost. The revenue impact done by legislative revenue, if consumers see 12% savings, the 0103 positive revenue impact is almost $1.3 million. The 0305 revenue impact, positive revenue impact, is almost $3 million. The difference, of course, between those two numbers is full implementation of the program. Our proposed, and this is just copying the state of California, we see this as a minimum. We think we have some room to grow on this. The first year was 25 cents. The second year was an additional 15 cents, bringing that to 40 cents. I tried to cost that out, bringing us to almost $1 million. Our proposal is split the baby, meaning you add your admin cost of 11 cents, your dispensing fee the first year, again, I have these costs out for the first year implementation, the second year implementation of 25 cents. Let's just go out 2 years to the 51 cent fees, splitting that in half, 25 cents being assumed by the state, and I'm rounding here, 25 cents being assumed by the consumer. because of the positive revenue impact, we have some money to work with, and that's where the cost would be covered to the state.
So these are costs that the pharmacist would get back as a dispensing fee?
They would keep the dispensing fee.
That's right.
Somehow I fail to see how that adds up to all these millions of dollars of supposed savings. If the consumers are saving that kind of money, it comes out of somebody's pocket, and I don't see that much going back in. And I haven't seen the state witness the last bill and one and two of the others that we've faced here in recent days in our committee, where the state is very interested in assuming any expense either isn't rammed down their throat or paid for. So,
Mr. Chairman,
I have a problem with this. Yes, Senator Carr.
When we are talking about number one, seniors, and we are talking about number two, a capped number of people that would be eligible for this 15% discount.
Capped in the sense that I believe under current federal law, if you're 65 and older, you're eligible for Medicare. But I think I'm wrong. My assumption.
You know, it's rather amazing to me. The federal government requires the state have a drug program in their Medicaid program. Now, as far as I'm concerned, it's up to the federal government to come up with something that goes with their welfare and their Medicare program.
Yeah.
It's not right to put that on our backs. We're having enough trouble funding the things that they're demanding that we fund right now anyway. And I'm just personally not interested in taking it out on any group of people. I don't see we're having enough trouble right now with the human resources budget. We're way short on any of the funds that we have in there. I don't see where we've got any room to squirm and putting any kind of a program in that's new that requires a whole bunch of new funds, and certainly not amounts to this amount. And
can I ask another question?
We have a bill in Senate Bill 9 that I think that we can pass and reasonably expect to get some help with. We add this to it. I think we're just throwing the whole thing down the drain. So that's my own opinion. Yes, Senator Carter.
Connie, when you look at the numbers, who were the people who supported this? Or who are the pharmaceutical companies that supported this in California, the pharmacist? I know you weren't prepared for this, but if you just have any information on the top of your head.
If my memory serves, obviously the senior community supported the bill in the state of California. My understanding is most pharmaceutical manufacturing companies were neutral. Ultimately, and Mr. Holt obviously will jump in here, there was a process of working with the pharmacist. The bill as written, the pharmacist opposed. They came back with the dispensing fee and actually a task force study. At that point, my understanding, the pharmacist supported the bill through their own ways and means process and working bills. The task force was removed. The dispensing fee was stuck into the DHS or their equivalent budget, and they were then neutral on the bill.
The third year out, another question, Mr.
Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Excuse me, one other question. Third year out, is there savings to the health plan or to the general fund budget from this?
Well, my assumption would be that the 03-05 revenue impact would be reflective of what you would see as a minimum out, especially if you consider the aging population in the state of Oregon. But I'm not the revenue officer, so.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry,
Tom. I would also say that these figures here, I don't believe, would come from LC either, or I mean revenue.
I'm sorry, Tom. Chair Fisher, actually, they are the documents, and I'm sorry again, this was a little bit on the fly, and I apologize for that, but documents that we submitted at the hearing for 876 actually were revenue, legislative revenue documents. Sorry.
And so you just reflected what was given
in
this? Yeah. Okay.
And I can get you copies of that again. I'm sorry, I don't have them with me at this moment.
But, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I want you and the members of this committee to know that this was no attempt to stuff anything down your throat. If we had known this was going to be done, we would have done it with dignity. So I want to make sure that is on the record.
Well, just as long as I'm allowed to put on the record that I don't see where the money balances here in these figures, and
Mr. Chairman, you're the chair. You can always put on record what you want.
Chair Fisher, if I may,
go ahead.
And members of the committee, I want to first speak to the question about where the pharmacists in California were on the proposal there. To the extent I can speak to it from conversations with my counterpart there, Connie's correct. The California Pharmacists Association opposed the bill in its original form. They never supported it. The situation there was somewhat different from here, and I think it would be fair to say that they took some lemons and made the best batch of lemonade they could out of it, knowing full well that a bill was going to pass there. As to the substance of the bill, I think there's a number of questions. We raised many of these in the previous hearing, having been just given this estimate prior to the hearing, and I do appreciate the courtesy of being given it. We do question, one, the alleged savings here, in part because it does not appear that legislative fiscal took into account lost income tax revenues from pharmacies and pharmacists who would be affected by this. We also question the actual savings to seniors if there were to be such a program. We have seen some numbers, which I'd be happy to attempt to pull together for the committee at some point, out of the California program. That is the only state that has such a program, as far as I'm aware, that the actual savings, if any, were less than 4% to those who participated. There are a number of other issues we have. A similar, not exactly the same program, but a similar program in Washington State is the subject of federal litigation right now. And I think the state could reasonably expect to incur some costs on that as well. But in general terms, we remain opposed to this concept. It's a price control bill on pharmacies and really directing the blame for drug costs a place where it doesn't belong. We have no control over the price of drugs, none. And the largest segment of cost is the cost of goods and the transporting of it to the pharmacy. The margins in pharmacies are very, very slim.
Connie, did you give Mr. Holt a copy of the numbers when we had the committee report before 876, when we heard they had to hear it?
Senator Carter, I'm sorry, which numbers?
Were these numbers the figures, I think it's in the term?
This is a new document.
Okay.
Produced late yesterday, and Mr. Holt got it before committee when the decision was made to do this.
Sure. Because of the 24-hour rule, you did not. This was nothing that you tried to blindside Mr. Holt on.
No, and in fact, a few weeks ago, I know Senator Brown had spoken to Mr. Holt about working together on this bill, and had mentioned the dispensing fee in California, and Ian had asked to come up with a number, and we took a shot. Because of the timing of the hearing, we took a shot and just went with the California.
You did not give the minority leader any draft proposals, not numbers on this?
Well, not yet, but in all fairness, I'm
not trying to be unfair.
Yeah.
I just want to know what the facts are.
Not yet.
Okay, then. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I can go on if you like, but if you'd rather not, I will stop.
No, I personally opposed to the H2 amendments to Senate Bill 9, and had made the decision that we would not bring 876 to a work session. If it's here, and in deference to my vice chair, I will, if she wishes to entertain a motion, I will allow her to do that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the H2 amendments to Senate Bill 9.
Senator Carter has Move the dash two amendments, Senate Bill 9. Is there objections to the discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Messersohn.
I guess I'm a little bit confused, and I have a question for Connie. You talked to me at 12 o'clock about these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall your mentioning to me that you were planning on putting this into Senate Bill 9. When did you make that decision?
Actually, it wasn't my decision. I think Senator Lee, or Senator Byer, excuse me, and Senator Carter and Senator Brown had some discussions at some point. There's actually, I mean, to be quite frank, another bill coming up on Friday that I think was the original idea.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Messersohn.
So when was the decision made?
After this work session. She knows nothing, Senator.
Oh, she knows a lot, just not about this.
Not this.
Connie, there's obviously some problems you indicated. I believe you indicated that there's a problem with the dash twos that you need to clean up. Wouldn't it be smarter to go ahead and try to develop those for that bill on Friday? And make sure you had it?
I would be happy to do what is the will of the committee and my members. So.
Okay. Senator Fisher.
That's why I'm here to serve.
Yes.
Members of the committee, I guess I would just like to look at it from a slightly different viewpoint. I personally do not support the dash two amendments, and my concern is for the original bill as written, that this would put me in the untenable situation of having to not support something that I have a great belief in, the original bill, and I would have to go on record against it.
Senator Shields.
Well, that's not really a problem, because we have a separate vote on the amendments and on the bill itself, so.
Jeff Lewis, Senator George.
I'm fine.
Will the clerk call a roll on dash two amendments?
Senator Rivera.
No.
Senator Shields.
Yes.
Senator George.
I know.
Senator Carter.
Aye.
Senator Fisher.
No, the motion fails. I would entertain a motion for accepting the dash one amendments.
Did you move?
Oh, yes, move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 9?
Senator George moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 9. Has there further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered. I would accept a motion to send the bill to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move Senate Bill 9 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Ways and Means.
Ways and Means, excuse me.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 9 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Do you include a due pass on that?
Yes, I did, yes.
Senator George includes a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call a roll?
Senator Russell.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
No.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Carter.
No.
Aye, motion carries. Close the work session on Senate Bill 9. And there's been a request to hold Senate Bill 906 over as they're still working on it to Friday. I hope that isn't the order of the day, because Friday will be a long day. Was that a long day's journey in the?
You can have it, Mr. Chair, I have every confidence in you.
If we come to agreement on it and have better amendments, I'm willing to do that, and we'll squeeze everything we can in, because I do intend to bang the gavel on our committee and shut it down as of Friday evening, or afternoon, whichever it is. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 45.
Judge, may I review this?
Yeah.
Thank you. Senate Bill 45 expands the authority of the optometrist to use oral and injected pharmaceutical agents for treatment and diagnostic purposes, eliminates requirements that the Board of Optometry have advice and guidance of the Board of Medical Examiners designing pharmaceutical agents for use by optometrists, eliminates the requirement that optometrists must consult with an ophthalmologist or other doctor of medicine prior to instituting treatment with anti-glaucoma medications. We heard this bill back in February. We do have attached dash seven amendments, which basically developed an optometric non-topical formulary, prohibits use of Schedule I and Schedule II drugs not on the formulary, require optometrists to demonstrate clinical competence in prescribing drugs, restores language in the bill that optometrists consult with physician prior to instituting anti-glaucoma medication, identify composition and administration of the formulary council, and require initial formulary to be developed and transmitted to the board by July 1, 2013.
I'm moving down just a little bit.
Oh, you're leaving your friends, huh?
Okay, let's, Jody Fisher, Peggy Annett, Jim Anderson.
More paper.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jody Fisher with the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. Thank you for the chance. Very
you
quickly.
You had your bodyguard on the way down.
Your army left you.
I know. Well, here I am, all alone. God, I really am. thank you for the chance to testify briefly on this. What I have given to you is a copy of a letter from our president, Dr. Gareth Tabor, a copy of an article from the Oregonian about the side effects of glaucoma drops, and also the Dash 5 amendments. We would like to submit for your consideration the Dash 5 amendments. These arose, or these came out of a meeting that Bill Cross, lobbyist of the optometrist, and I attended in Senator Fisher's office, where he asked us to see if we could come to some kind of a consensus on our differences on this bill. We, in fact, did that and had a wonderful agreement that lasted about 10 days until a week ago Friday, a few hours before the hearing, when the optometrists pulled their support from that agreement.
Jody, that's not true. They did that much prior to that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's been a long time ago that they did that. Right after we had that bill drafted, Bill had gotten back to his people, and they said they did not wish to even have the bill go any further if we had to continue with that amendment. And so that's when I went to work to try to get together and see if we could go beyond that. And that's when I started drafting the subsequent, I think, Dash 6 and Dash 7 amendments. So,
I'm sorry, Senator. I was not informed that they had withdrawn their support until the hearing. So I apologize. I thought that that's when they withdrew their support, but I did not know that until 15 minutes before the hearing. What the Dash 5 amendments include is what was in that original agreement, and there were two differences. There were two main parts of it. One was, as you remember, we had insisted that the Board of Medical Examiners approve the formulary. And we withdrew that, and I came up with this formulary council, which is a consultative, a mixed group of professionals, optometrists and ophthalmologists, who would pass on the optometric formulary. But in exchange for that, we required that topicals, new topicals, and oral pharmaceuticals be run through that process. We were not trying to turn back the clock on topicals. In fact, we put in a grandfather clause for all of the topicals that are now approved by the Board of Optometry to be used. We weren't trying to roll back the clock. But new topical pharmaceuticals and orals and injectables would go through this collaborative mixed group. The reason we insisted on that is, number one, because it's just plain good public policy. It makes absolutely no difference whether you use a pharmaceutical through the eye, through the mouth, injected, or in the ear. The side effects of that pharmaceutical are the same, medically and pharmacologically. There are many new topicals coming out, and that's why I attached the glaucoma article, for example, that have horrendous side effects, particularly people with heart conditions and respiratory conditions that can be fatal. it makes no sense to have two processes to establish what is on the formulary and what is not. And that was a line in the sand for us. I am very sorry and very disappointed that this fell through, because my members, one, think it's good public policy, but even more than that, we thought what we had a chance for was a kind of lasting peace. And a group that would look at pharmaceuticals, it could look at other procedures, it could look at sober practice, and get this issue out of the legislature and have professionals deciding these issues and not have it as part of a political process. I'm also a little personally disappointed because I came in good faith. I did not stonewall. I put a proposal on the table that I said was my bottom line. And I do feel a little like I'm having my head handed to me in the Dash 7 amendment that have taken what I thought was an agreement, stripped what my members liked out of it, which is including all of the topical, new topicals, and now I'm faced with the Dash 7 amendments that don't have what my folks think is the bottom line. So for that, I'm quite disappointed. And I would recommend to you the Dash 5 amendments. I think they're, again, I think they're good public policy, and I think it's the basis for a lasting peace.
Well, let's go back to the attorneys. There's nothing, apparently, that we can write into the law in the way of grandfathering something in that assures that continues on or should continue on. It can't be written into law. There could be something come up that we don't know anything about 10 days from now that determined that one shouldn't be used. And once you get a council like that, there was no assurance whatsoever that they could not have done away with all the work that had gone into getting the 1993 situation of topicals more or less handled. I thought, did I hear you say you had a Oregonian article?
I believe it's the second page of the handout, New Glaucoma Drugs.
Did I miss it? Okay.
I just added that as an example of why there is kind of silly to make a distinction between a topical and a non-topical in terms of the dangers.
Right.
And why for our policy basis, we wanted to have them all included. We were willing to grandfather in every substance that is on that formulary now, and we wrote that into the Dash 5 amendments that's in there. All of the substances that they can use now, I'm not trying to turn back the clock. All the substances that they can now prescribe would be on that formulary, and they're required to be on that formulary as of January 2002. We even allowed the board, if in the next 6 months they want to adopt a whole bunch of topicals, they could probably do that. And they would be included in the formulary. So we did grandfather.
Well, you know, I'm not saying that glaucoma isn't a very complicated situation, but the thing boils down to the fact, and I'm going to go ahead before we get too deep into this and let the other two folks testify here about it, and then we'll work on it. But basically, I'm not flooded with people that have operated in a way that has used these topical medications in ways that have caused huge problems to the general public. Nor does I, as I glance at this glaucoma drug article, do I see that that's the case. It's merely outlining what it takes to handle a situation like that, which is indeed complicated and certainly important to the people that have it. Go ahead, Peggy or Jim, whichever.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. And my issues on this have long standing gone back to the scope of practice. And as you know, there's a history of the optometrist pursuing a course to become independent primary care eye providers. And what concerns me is the oversight issue in concert with some of the past practices of the board, because previously they have been required to apply or use topicals in consultation with an ophthalmologist, and in fact their administrative rules and statutory requirements had laid that out. What I handed in today, and I've talked to a number of you about it, is the fact that the board has since 1998, actually gone in and independently removed the requirements that they operate in consultation with a medical provider with these kinds of prescriptions. And that is of some concern in that, as I said, the board has done that over the history of this extension of the topical prescription and done that over the objection of both the Board of Medical Examiners and the Oregon Medical Association. My concern is that even though you may well not have heard complaints about something that has been awry, that does not necessarily mean or justify the fact that one can go in, a board can independently go in and remove from administrative rule something that's statutorily required. I see it as sort of a post facto decision to allow them more latitude than what would be inferred from what was included in statute. The insurance angle on it, of course, is the reimbursement issue. And when the optometrist proposed some a formulary or actually a listing of CPT codes or billing codes at the end of 1999, their specific statement was they wanted to include these in administrative rule because they want to be sure that a medical director for an insurance company could not make a unilateral decision that a procedure is outside the scope of practice of pharmacy. That is where we come at it, and this is so the two factors that are significant for me. Pardon? Excuse me, for optometry. That was mixing my metaphors here. But that was in a letter actually from the Board of Optometry to the ophthalmologist trying to explain why they wanted to list all of these particular procedures in their administrative rule. What they subsequently did was rewrite their administrative rules in the form of questions. And suffice it to say, in reviewing the other scope of practice statutes as well as administrative rules, it is a unique approach to define scope of practice in a series of questions. And when you bring all of these factors together, it suggests to me that particularly when you get into the pharmaceutical arena, there should be some oversight, particularly in view of some of the decisions that had been made previously. Thank you.
Yes. Does that mean that have you had a chance to look at the Dash 5 amendment?
I have.
Does it mean that you can support the Dash 5 amendments and don't support the bill? What does all this mean?
It means that I support the Dash 5s because of the sort of oversight that it provides. I still have concerns about the utilization portion of it.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Jim Anderson, Oregon Medical Association. I can't add much more than what my two colleagues have. The OMA is in complete support of the Dash 5. We were in support of the Dash 4 amendments until they were superseded by the Dash 5. Clearly, to stay consistent with the other testimony that we've given earlier this session, this is clearly a break of scope of practice. And we would, again, only echo what Ms. Annette and Ms. Fisher have said and are in complete support of the Dash 5 amendments and would urge you to move forward with those.
There have been some statements made here, and we're probably going to have to divide this and come and go a bit in this hearing. So I want the folks from the...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Could I ask a question before you? Could you define, for the record and for me, the difference between the Dash 5 and the Dash 7?
Mr. Chairman, the primary difference is under the area of topical pharmaceutical, of TPAs, topical pharmaceutical agents. Currently, the Board of Optometry has the authority to adopt a topical formulary for optometrists with the advice and guidance of the Board of Medical Examiners. The initial topical formulary was put together by a group of optometrists and ophthalmologists appointed by the governor. That has been the topical formulary, and there have been a few changes to that. What we had suggested in the Dash 5 amendments is that all of those topical pharmaceuticals that have been adopted to date up until January 2002 would be grandfathered into the formulary. But that new topicals and oral pharmaceuticals and injectable pharmaceuticals go through this advisory process of the Formulary Council. Those, and my understanding of the Dash 7 is that they carve out all topical pharmaceuticals. That there would be essentially two processes to get on the formulary, depending upon whether it was a topical agent or whether it was an injectable or an oral pharmaceutical or however you want to inject.
That's correct, and the topical would stay exactly as it is now.
Correct.
Sure, follow-up, Senator. It's not a follow-up to that question, but another question. As you can imagine, I think all of us have been lobbied all over the board on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And in my discussions with optometrists in my district this morning, it was really interesting to me that the point they were making was that there's not a big issue between the ophthalmologist and the optometrist, but they work very well together. And the concern they had was that the real problem is that when there's a lack of service available to the patients, that many people with eye problems go to the GP doctors, and then they and the general practitioners, and that they end up having to resolve some very serious issues when there's problems with what was done there. So I guess I'm a little confused as what the battles are here. I understand what we're talking about the issue here today, but if we're really talking about safety to the patients and we're really talking about service that's available to the patients, I'm wondering if we're not misguiding our efforts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meserly, I do believe that there is not a huge battle between optometrists and ophthalmologists, that they actually work well together. And I think, in fact, that's part of the reason that we were able to reach agreement early in this. I do think that there are some differences with the Board of Optometry and the oversight of the Board of Optometry, and I think that's what's at the heart of this. I think that if you talk to, I mean, like I said, for my members, the idea of having a formulary council that was made up of optometrists, medical doctors, some of whom are ophthalmologists, some of whom might be primary care physicians, an academic in optometry, an academic from the medical school, and a pharmacist, was a big enough tent that they felt they could get some agreement and some collaboration. And they were willing to try that process as a way of beginning more of this collaboration on scope of practice, et cetera, and getting out of this nasty fight that we have been in. And I think that, our Dash 5 amendments were an attempt to do just that.
Mr. Chair, if I may make a comment here, and this is in response to the observation that this is not a change from current practice with regard to the topicals. If you look at page 2 on the bill, lines 40 and 41, in fact, it has been statutorily required that pharmaceutical agents for topical use in the practice of optometry must be with the advice and guidance of the Board of Medical Examiners. In fact, this changes the current statutory requirement by deleting those provisions, which is the point that I was trying to make. So, in fact, this is a change in that area. It is true that they had done that by administrative rule previously. It is not true that they had the statutory change.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am not sure if the Dash 7 amendments delete that language. The Dash 5 amendments reinstate it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm becoming more and more convinced, I'll say it again, that we've got to figure out some way. If I'm fortunate enough to be on this committee in next session, or unfortunate, however you want to look at it, I'm really becoming interested in trying to combine some boards. I think that these kind of fights are just unnecessary and, quite frankly, embarrassing, and I'm sure they are to a lot of people. But
I'd like to call the Wayne Shoemaker, Schumacher, and Joan Miller and David Plunkett. ahead in whatever order you want.
I came prepared to discuss the Dash 7, but I think we're going to go back. Pardon me?
Would you introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joan Plume Miller. I'm president of the Board of Optometry. With me on your left is David Plunkett, the executive director of the Board of Optometry, and Mr. Wayne Schumacher, executive director of the Oregon Physicians, Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. You know, for nearly a decade now, the board has had the responsibility to deal with optometric use of topical pharmaceuticals. We have done that very responsibly. Every time we've looked at the issues, we've requested advice and guidance from the Board of Medical Examiners and from any interested parties. We've informed these people. We've granted extensions when they've requested extensions because communication within their organization didn't have all their sub-parties be aware of the issues going on. We have dealt with this responsibly. I find it very frustrating when we get into these issues and when our board is painted as if we're not responsible. Our mission is not to protect optometrists or to expand their scope. Our mission is to protect the public and to enforce the statutes. The whole administrative rule process is one where we can make rules that are more restrictive than statute, but we can't write statute. That's what you do. And we have never tried to circumvent anything. The issue that was brought up to you with regard to the CPT codes, people taking things out of context misunderstood the whole point. The point was Oregonians receiving care that was within the scope of practice of optometrists as reviewed and defined by the Board of Optometry were not getting reimbursement for certain procedures that were obviously within the statutory definition. We followed the lead of other states, where other states had gone to a CPT code definition. That caused a problem simply because when you have CPT codes, they can
CPT code.
Their current procedure terminology. It has to do with if you pluck out an eyelash, there's a code for that. And plucking out an eyelash, I think we'd probably all agree that that's a non-invasive procedure. All optometrists agree with that. Not necessarily all medical directors would agree with that. There can be a medical director in another state says, you know, no, that's surgery. We define that to be surgery, and therefore an optometric patient couldn't have an office visit paid for that had to do with that code. But there are times when a code can define a number of procedures, maybe grades. If you have something of a 1 severity, everyone would agree optometrists could do it. If we have something of a 10 severity, maybe no one would agree an optometrist would do it. But since the code method where the Board of Optometry was looking at a code saying, we can imagine one situation where that code would need to be used that would meet the requirements of the statute, that it's not invasive surgery, that it doesn't require injection, that it doesn't require an oral medication. And in those situations, that optometric patient should get reimbursement for that optometric procedure. Whereas other people might look at that same code number and say, well, in some situations, that might involve a much more dramatic procedure that wouldn't be included. So we went back and said, basically, when we look at whether a code is covered, we actually withdrew the way we proposed it originally because we accepted the advice and guidance or perhaps the confusion that we had created and tried to create a situation that anyone could look at a procedure and say, what really does our law say? And our law says it can't be invasive, it can involve orals, it can involve injections. If it involves a medication, it needs to be topical. So I think some things have been misinterpreted people have tried to paint this board as some sort of a irresponsible board, and I would say that if we look at the communications, the facts, that they're on our side. Regarding pharmaceuticals, we've been dealing with topical pharmaceuticals, and when we asked for that, when optometrists, the board isn't asking for any privilege, but when optometrists asked for that privilege, that was painted as being dangerous. And people here in front of committee like yours came to admit, ophthalmology came to admit that the drugs that optometrists were granted in 1975, the dilation drugs, that those as a category were actually much more dangerous than the topicals they were asking for. So, you know, we're looking at a situation where people are trying to scare others, and the record shows that we have not received complaints regarding optometric use of topical pharmaceuticals, including glaucoma pharmaceuticals that are now being painted as something that somehow someone else needs to be controlling, creating a problem that doesn't exist. So we have communicated with you before regarding the Dash 5 amendments where those would create the grandfathering, that didn't work. That language simply doesn't work, and we are in favor of the Dash 7. I have a very brief...
Mr. Chairman, explain why it doesn't work in the Dash 5.
Well, our attorney looked at that and said that it creates in stone something that would need to be changed either by the legislature or, let's see, created two situations.
I'm David Plunkett, Executive Director of the Board. It made it impossible to change except through the legislature, or it meant that it could be, there was nothing to prevent that formulary from being eliminated or revised 1 month, you know, after this went into place.
Mr. Chairman, and that was my question, is that if a person just tweaks the formula just a little bit, then it would go off of the list of being grandfathered in. Is that the concern?
Okay. The board supports the Dash 7 amendment. We believe the Dash 7 amendments have taken into consideration the legitimate concerns of the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology and the Board of Optometry. It allows the status quo to exist with respect to the designation of topical pharmaceuticals and puts in place a council with equal representation from optometry and ophthalmology. The Dash 7 amendment addresses the major concern over reduction or compromise of the board's authority over its licensees. It would restore the current law regarding topical pharmaceuticals. That's a law that works, and someone can say they're not trying to turn back the clock, but that certainly is what it appears to be. The Dash 7 allows the board to review the approved non-topical formulary as determined by the council, adopt all or a portion of it. It does not allow the board to expand or add to the approved non-topical or change any of the approved protocols. Therefore, the board can adopt by rule a non-topical formulary that it believes would be in the best interest of optometric patients and citizens of Oregon. The Board of Optometry takes its mission to protect the public very seriously. We have followed all protocols regarding administrative rules and have granted extensions when such requests have been made. We will continue to make every effort to communicate with all interested parties and act in a manner to benefit the public.
Please forgive me. I don't know your name. Can you tell me how tweaking the bill itself could the formulary could make the a particular medication in the formulary fall off? I was trying to follow you guys' language, but it's okay. I'm so glad you got me. How can that happen? In regards to Senator George's question.
Chair Fisher, Senator Carter, it would be possible through grandfathering to revise or eliminate any of the topicals and start over if the council so chose, either by the category of drugs or by the protocols for their use, any of those issues.
Yeah. so then I don't want you guys that was up here at first to go away, because you need to come back and put on record that you can and you can't, because I would be against that, because we've done too much work in the state to get to where we are with optometrists and ophthalmologists working together for that to happen. So I want to make sure that they put it on record.
Well, what we're saying is when we had our attorney, the Attorney General's office, look at this, their interpretation was, it was either one or the other, it was in cast in stone, in which case the council couldn't change it, only you, the legislature, could change it, or it could be revised or eliminated in any way that as the council so chose. So there's just no way that the board could agree to that kind of language. It puts us back to 1991. And I might add that this hasn't been a huge issue. The law passed the second time around in 1993.
How is it?
The board put rules into place, and to correct some statements that were made, the board appointed the committee. It wasn't the governor's office. The board did that in consultation with the governor's office. Those laws went into effect in May of 94. They were in place, unchanged, until last year at all. And even at this time, the drugs stay the same. Only some of the protocols were eliminated, because when the board initially put this in place, they did it very cautiously. And they put some extra protocols in there that they felt added safety and give practitioners time. Some of the protocols were eliminated last spring, I think it was. That's the only change in this since 94. So it isn't a huge issue, as I see it.
Go ahead, Wayne.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. For the record, my name is Wayne Schumacher. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. And I would particularly like to commend the chair and his efforts in working to develop this group of amendments that meets the intent of 7045. We did indeed try to work with ophthalmology to come up with a set of amendments that indeed attempted to preserve the initial intent of the bill and to protect the public interest. And for the most part, 90% of what you're seeing in Dash 7 and in Dash 5 are indeed those. And with the help of Senator Fisher, we have come up with what we consider to be actually the best set of amendments, which is Dash 7. The predominant difference between 7 and 5 are literally in two areas, and that has been discussed initially. It's the area of naming the formulary to be a non-topical formulary, and that the council would have jurisdiction over that, as opposed to just strictly an optometric formulary. And I won't go into that as to why that's such a big issue. We do believe, however, that that is a major issue, and so essentially Dash 7 is why that's very important. The final issue really was just simply a clarification, and again, it's a change that once again bent to the wishes of the opposition, and that was to essentially provide an option for I must say it was probably our amendment that we were concerned about. And it basically allows the Board of Optometry to accept or reject any or all of that formulary that's suggested from the council. The reason being is that there was a concern that maybe there would be something that would be too liberal coming from the council and the board could not, there would be just no firewall. That doesn't seem to be a major issue, and frankly it's a logical change as opposed to an accept or reject kind of situation where you'd have no formulary at all. So those are the two main differences. Dash 7 is an extremely well looked at bill or set of amendments, and we would hope that you would support Dash 7 amendments and to pass those if you would. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
There have been several accusations against your board actions as far as some of the things that were alluded to there that were removed from the rules. You mentioned that, I guess, in the spring of 2000. And I do have been furnished two letters criticism for that that were entered to you as a board, but absolutely no evidence of anything else of how you responded, and it was entered in basically in the light that those criticisms were entered and absolutely nothing was done about it. Could you elaborate on the process that you went through in that changing of your OARs?
Basically, the board originally, when those were adopted, looked at a number of protocols that were deemed to be appropriate in 1993 that in some rare instances could be inappropriate. If you look at, we review records from both optometrists and ophthalmologists. There are times when in reviewing a complaint, we'll basically ask for every record of every doctor that's seen this patient. And in reviewing ophthalmological records, we find that there are instances when what was proposed as the only way to do something within the committee, such as you must always emphasize, always use, measure intraocular pressure by applanation prior to instigating corticosteroid treatment. If you look at an ophthalmologist's office today, I would grant that many ophthalmologist's offices use a technician operating a tonal pen, which is not an applanation tonometer, to measure that eye pressure. But you had created in 1993 a situation where an optometrist couldn't use that same instrument that is now much more common than in 93 to measure eye pressure because the rule said it had to be by applanation. Or there could be a situation where a cornea might not be needing further assault that an applanation tonometer would do on that cornea, and there was already in the record an established baseline. The problem with intraocular pressure is when you prescribe certain topical medications, that pressure can go up too high. And so it's important to have a baseline. But there might be a situation where you have a baseline from a previous examination, but here our administrative rule said immediately prior to prescribing this medication, this must be done. This was creating a standard that isn't logical in every situation. In the absence of having complaints, what's at all? In this area, we looked at saying those parts of the protocols that are more restrictive than statute were there as a precautionary method. We haven't had complaints. We received testimony that they were not necessarily logical, and we received some letters saying they were, but we looked at the entire base of information that we received and made a decision, much like you guys do.
Well, what I was referring to was not so much that, but the situation where the consulting with the ophthalmologist was dropped from the actual OARs.
The wording always was ophthalmologist or medical doctor, and I think that is the impression of ophthalmology that what was adopted by the council said it had to be an ophthalmologist rather than, you know, what was adopted by the Board of Optometry when we first adopted things in 94 had or. And so that's not a change. I think that people, that there's ophthalmologists that believe that it always was ophthalmologist and it never was.
Senator Fisher, there's one other thing there. the language is in statute. Matter of fact, it's on page 3 of the bill. Which says, prior to instituting treatment for glaucoma medication, optometrists shall consult with an ophthalmologist, a doctor of medicine, or osteopathy. Any of those three is not a... And we had in our rules a more restrictive rule than this, in which we said there had to be an annual consultation. The board determined, after reviewing those, that annual consultation was no longer required. They felt it was no longer required, and so they eliminated the annual consultation. the statute still exists and we still enforce it. There has to be a consultation. Initial consultation.
The thing that I'm talking about is letters that you received, at least one from the Oregon Medical Association and another one, I believe from the optometrists that indicated, or the Board of Medical Examiners, excuse me, that indicated that you had dropped out to come to the, and was entered in protest at the hearing that you had to change these rules and regulations. And the inference to me was that you rode right over it, that you took no notice of it. And in talking with you, I got a little different opinion of this, and that's the process I wanted to describe. In other words, you received these letters. When did you receive them? How much notice did you give out ahead of time before you called this hearing, et cetera? Go through that process for me.
Well, I'm doing this from memory, so you have to forgive me, but it's we met all the statutory requirements for administrative rule requirements.
30-day notification for a hearing?
For notice of hearing. We had a request for an extension of that time, both from the BME, as I recall, and the Oregon Medical Association, which we granted an extra 45 days, I might add.
Did you receive these complaints well in advance of your hearing date, or did they come in just on the eve of the hearing?
Yes, at the very last minute when we received them.
So the 30 days basically went by, you had your hearing, and at the hearing, or right on that particular time frame, is when these letters of complaint, or in a verbal complaint, I guess, came.
Yes. And
so you extended it 45 days after that and extended the hearing process. So you
yes.
did at least acknowledge that someone had been there and had made some...
I think we gave everyone that wanted to speak to it ample opportunity to speak to it, and the board reflected on those before it adopted.
What kind of response did you get during the next 45 days?
Very little. We can give you copies of the evidence that we looked at, but you know, we weighed all, you know, like the original council weighed different inputs, and like we originally weighed when we made the original administrative rules. You don't, you know, seldom, in the reason you have hearings is because people have different opinions, and we look at those opinions and say when there's disagreement, we have to make a decision as to what we believe is safe for the public. I believe we've been conservative in that application.
Is it required in OARs? I'm not a, have not been in an agency or involved in the OAR process. Is it required that the OARs contain every single wording and so forth of the ORSs?
My understanding is quite the opposite. The OARs are not reiterating what the statute says. The OARs can be more restrictive. It can give, you know, it can define things in greater detail, but it can't exceed. So if the statute says there must be an initial consult with an ophthalmologist, an MD, or a DO, we could have in administrative rules said, well, we think it should be an ophthalmologist. But quite frankly, the concern with glaucoma medications is not as much the ophthalmologist consultation. At times might be, you know, the ophthalmologist might be used in consultation as to, is this really glaucoma? You know, that's not an easy decision. That's not something that, you know, an ophthalmologist shoots from the hip and says, yeah, that's glaucoma. That's a decision you make after doing a number of different tests. So an optometrist might say, I don't know whether I think this person needs treatment or not. I'm leaning for it, but I want an ophthalmologist consult as to whether we should treat. But what is often as important or more important is, how is this person's medical health? If I prescribe a beta blocker, a topical beta blocker, and this patient has a heart problem, am I going to cause a problem, you know, with that beta blocker that's going to adversely affect this person's health? So the consultation that's most important may be with an MD who is that person's primary care physician.
Well, again, what I'm trying to find out here is, what the law requires you to do, because you've been accused of taking these things out summarily, when in reality, maybe you did decide against not leaving them in, but certainly didn't do it summarily. And in my estimation, you did allow securities and practice more time for hearings. But what I'm getting at is, if you leave something out of the OARs that's in the ORSs, does that relieve your
ORS,
your licensees from still sticking by the ORSs?
ORS is what's cast, what's chiseled in stone, as far as I'm concerned. And as we, when we took out some protocols, we tried to make it eminently clear that that did, that when that protocol was important to the standard of care, the Board of Optometry would deal very harshly with someone who varied from that. But we felt like, just as medical doctors don't have listed in their administrative rules every type of clinical decision, how they do it, that optometric physicians could make similar clinical judgments based on the data they'd received, the additional testing, the consultation with an MD, come up with a treatment plan for a patient.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman, no. I just wanted the crafters of my amendments to come back and put on record they're not trying to do, trying to craft legislation that would make it easy for one of the formulas to fall off the formulary.
Well, I don't think it's a matter of whether they're desiring to do it or not. If they have an attorney's opinion that it can be done under that rule and regulation, there is no assurance it can't be done, and that's what
Mr. Chairman,
causing the whole concern over this.
Right, but I thought since Ms. Fisher is an attorney, she's a lawyer, we can get, she's still under the codes and ethics of the bar of the state, we can get her on record.
I'm perfectly willing to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you. Jim Anderson, too, with the Medical Association.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you, Senator Carr. I have only two comments. One is that we are not disputing the consultation with an ophthalmologist or a medical doctor or a doctor of osteopathy. Any one of them is fine. We're not asking that. We're not upset about the fact that it can be either of those. But the second thing is, in terms of the grandfathering, I would like you to keep in mind that the Attorney General is the attorney for the Board of Optometry. He is the advocate for the Board of Optometry. Legislative Council is your attorney, and Legislative Council believes that the grandfathering clause, in fact, works and will, in fact, grandfather any substances on that have been on the formulary before. So your attorney, Legislative Council, doesn't see the same problem.
Your intent?
Our intent was to grant, was not to turn back the clock to 1994 when the topical formulary was first implemented. In fact, quite the contrary. The contrary was to grandfather in any of the medications that they are now using, and only to roll in new medications that may be coming along.
The tenets of your support, Mr. Anderson.
I would support what Ms. Fisher has said. Jim Anderson, Oregon Medical Association, Mr. Chair. I would simply like to comment also that everyone here is and does know that there have been attempts on the ballot to try to have some review of the OARs at the time that rulemaking processes do take place. There are some agencies, and I'm not pointing fingers at this time, but there are some agencies that take extreme latitude with the way they interpret statutes that you pass during a legislative assembly. And some of them stick very closely to that statute. Some of them take quite a bit of latitude with how they word the OAR. So these are the areas, and they're very gray areas that we work in all the time. So it's incumbent upon us, as well as the legislative body, I believe, to watch how the OARs are done and how they are prepared by various agencies.
And, Mr. Chairman, my intent, if indeed
the Dash 5 amendments are passed, I will be here for another whole session, and if things go well, I'll be here until I'm 90. I'm exaggerating. I'm exaggerating. That's right, next week. But, he is so corny. And I'm going to be the old woman hitting him with my cane, too.
Yeah, and, don't you be beating me with it.
I'm going to go on record as saying I didn't laugh too loud at that.
That's right. We're the same category. But it is my intention, if that happens to the Optometrical Society or Association, that being around myself, I worked hard, 85 through 91, in helping to support progressivity with the optometrist. So, I don't want my work turned around. And if you don't believe me, since I see some heads moving, you can call your own Dr. Randall, and he will tell you how much work I have done with you guys. But anyway, just need to come out there.
Well, the thing of it is, I guess, also I would remind people about how the population has treated all of those efforts to have a legislative oversight of the OARs.
Right.
And they've been just about as popular as new taxes with their voters, so I'm not sure how relevant. And I would say we do have, and I've had extreme interest many times in the OAR productions of various agencies, and the obvious thing, I see at this point in time, two agencies that have a very human past history dealing with each other here still on a basis, unfortunately, of not a whole lot of trust. And regardless of all the protestations of not imputing any chicanery on the part of their counterparts, it amounts to about that same thing. And the problem is, again, and I've got to think that when you come to legislative council is hired by the legislature for the legislature's use, not hired to protect the law once it's established and out in practice in this state. However, the Attorney General's office is. And we've had plenty of experience with attorneys and lawyers in our caucuses, and I've never yet seen any group of them agree 100% with another on how things go. So I have some real problems with putting something in where we have known opportunities when we can avoid that. And frankly, having been a member of a particular profession and had a board, I am not willing to just impute offhand the fact that any board wants to get their professionals in trouble or put them and hang them out on a limb liability-wise. And we've had several incidents where basically there's reference to the fact that some might take this thing and run with it, and I'm saying if you get an individual that's out of line, you deal with them, and that's what those boards are there for. And you can't show me a profession that has a board and a profession that even doesn't have a board, but one of their members hasn't turned rogue sometime or another and done things that need to bring them up for disciplinary action or to have them pitched out on their ear by their constituents. So, beside this, my way of thinking is we've had a situation where we've had pretty reasonable application of topical substances to, in the past, not a decade, but about 6 or 7 years at least, and we have a pretty good history of that. And I'm saying it's about time we heal some of these little petty differences about what kind of procedure and thing that we've used and look at what has been accomplished. And I've got to say this, I have definite evidence and several evidences of where primary care physicians have messed up people's eyesight because they've tried to deal with it in the doctor's office rather than going to a more dedicated professional in that arena. I don't have any of those evidences. I only have the point that it might happen. It could happen. I don't see that it has happened. I don't hear that the Board of Optometry is flooded with complaints and legal processes against their members that have used optical
substances wrongly. It's very frustrating to me. I have a very firm conviction that when people can show me and demonstrate that they are trained to use certain things and to do certain treatments, that they are denied because they're considered to be a bit inferior in that they have chosen a different line of profession than someone else. I'm not unwilling to listen to good, solid authority when it can bring the evidences of things. The newspaper article in here doesn't say one single thing about any misappropriation of any drugs in any particular situation to anyone. It just merely speaks that there's a process that goes through, and it can be a complicated and technical process. And I agree with that. I think it is. But our training is taking place. I don't believe the optometrists are cloning themselves. I believe they have very highly trained physicians and people and specializing in certain areas as their teachers. They're not going out optometrists making optometrists any more than the ophthalmologists don't have highly trained people training them. And ultimately, you eventually get to the top of the route where you don't have any choice but to, because there's nobody above it. And I go back to a situation where a professor of mine had made a study in a certain area, and when he came to defend his doctoral thesis, there wasn't anybody literally in the world that knew as much as he knew about it. And they sat down and had coffee because he knew more than the professors were, you know, and he didn't have to defend his thesis. Well, you arrive at that eventually if you get high enough in the statue and in the hierarchy of things. And otherwise than that, you deal with people in the vein of what they're licensed for, what they've studied for, and what they're supposed to be doing. And it bothers me when we have these battles because there isn't a cut and dried line that we can draw, and so you can't come any farther than that line. There's times when you shouldn't maybe go up to that line. There's times when you have every right to go past the line, especially in the medical arena. And it's frustrating to me to do this, and I don't want to abuse the situation. I've had a few accusations and a few darts thrown in my direction. I'm going to let them stick. I'll pull them out when I get out of here and toss them in the wastebasket and not worry about it. But it's not up to me to be vindictive. It's up to me to decide what people are capable of doing, what they ought to be doing, and that's what I'm trying to do in this basis. And I've spent a lot of time in this, and I have seen a reason that I believe, and in talking with my optometrist and the knowledge of things, I believe that there's things that we need to do to help this cause along. And that's why, personally, I had the dash sentence drawn. It wasn't to subvert anybody. It wasn't to make anybody look bad. It wasn't to be underhanded to anybody. I've made every attempt I could to keep both sides engaged in this thing. It's come to my attention now, finally, that, frankly, we're going to have to make a decision, whether it's fun for us or hard for us or whatever it is, because there is a gap here where there's an unwillingness to meet in the middle, if there is such a middle. So, respectfully, Mr. Chair, I'm the preacher on this committee.
Okay.
They all said amen.
But I want well established, and I also want to say one more thing. In my, as Paul said, and finally, brethren, you preached the last half of his sermon. Finally, brethren, I want a definite attitude on parts of both groups that they're not going to be submarining each other. And that's something that I'm going to make very, very plain. I want the boards to try to work in conjunction with each other, and I want the council to do the very level best job it can do. And please try to listen to the other groups. Try to have a little bit of heart in how you're dealing with things with each other. And whatever the decision is today, and whatever goes out of the House, and whatever signed by the governor, if it is, then let's work on this thing in a way to make it better so that we don't have to come in here and fight. We'll come in here and say, yes, we do have this training. We need these things. Hopefully the council will be looking at that constantly through the time, and it will erase and get rid of a bunch of the strain that we feel here with two groups working together, because believe me, I respect both sides of this and both the folks on both sides of this issue equally. I think there's entirely good people in every facet of our medical association. I would defy anybody to claim that a lobbyist hadn't done every single thing they could do for their group in this process and try to maintain where they were supposed to be going and the instructions they had from their group. It's not a backhand against any individual whatsoever, and frankly, you've given us a tough nut to decide, and I'm going to go into the decision-making process here and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 45 and open the work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I'd like to move the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 45.
Senator Carter moves the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 45. Is there further discussion? Objection? I have, and I don't know all the rules and regulations, but I have a personal objection, and I'm going to call a vote on this amendment.
Well, hold on.
Senator Carter.
Is offering this amendment before you feel as if my amendment is out of order?
No.
Okay.
I just say I'm going to call for a vote on it because no one else objected, but I say I personally have an objection, and so I'm going to call a vote to the Dash 5. Will the clerk call a roll?
Senator Mitchell?
No.
Senator Sills?
No.
Senator George?
No.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
No. The motion fails. I would accept the motion to accept the Dash 7 amendments.
So moved.
Senator George moved the Dash 7 amendments. Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I will be a no on Senate Bill 45 Dash 7 amendments. I think in principle and in practice that as you do that, we need to work hard to work together and more collaboratively, but I think when you find groups like the state's medical association and the association as well as the medical society that have come together and to advise us on things of this nature, that we have to be cognizant of what we allow people to have input in. I'm a counselor by profession, not a psychologist, but I feel as if my training is equivalent, but it still does not give me the title because I'm not that. So for that reason, I will be a no vote.
Okay. With that announcement, I will ask the clerk to call a roll on voting on the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 45.
Senator Mitchell?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
No.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. I will...
You guys want me to carry this bill?
No.
I will accept a motion now to amend the bill.
So moved.
Senator Shields moves Senate Bill 45 as amended with Dash 7 amendments. Is that a due pass recommendation?
You asked me to move it. You didn't tell me what else you wanted me to do.
Well, I just want to make sure for the record.
Just listen.
No, I'm hardly awake. Come on. 3:20. Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. Senator Shields has agreed to a due pass amendment to be added, or a due pass recommendation to be added to his motion. Is there further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call a roll?
Senator Mitchell?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
No.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. The motion carries. And Senator Shields, do you wish to carry this?
No.
I will carry it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 45 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 482.
I think we need that, Senator. Senate Bill 482 requires Health Division to adopt rules requiring immunization against hepatitis A for school entry, appropriates money from general fund, and declares emergency effective July 1, 2001. We do have Dash 1 amendments, which are attached to your summary. In essence, Dash 1 amendments replace the current bill. requiring the Health Division to consult with medical community and others to develop a plan to be implemented by July 1, 2006, include hepatitis A and pneumococcal conjugate vaccines and immunization requirements for school and school-based daycare entries. As amended, this has minimal impact fiscally. This does have our current subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, we have a list of...
Is it going to hit there even with amendments?
I thought they said it was no.
Oh, it's minimal.
Mm-hmm.
So but it'll go there even with amendments? Oh, it won't. Okay.
Okay.
Well, we have Dr. Hedberg to answer questions. Dr. Hedberg would like to come up, and I'm not sure if we have any questions, but...
Mr. Chairman, I'm
here she is, Senator Carter.
I'm just prepared to give you a motion on the bill if there are not any questions.
I don't particularly have any questions. Are you satisfied with the presentation the staff has made for the bill here?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, we're actually very pleased with the amendment. I think it'll be very, these are both important public health problems, hepatitis A and pneumococcal disease, and we'd be very happy to work on a plan to implement the vaccination.
Just want to make sure that we do get what we need to have here done so that we don't come up and somebody said, well, what in the world did they mean by that? And we've got no proper record. So if you're satisfied that it's been taken care of, why? Remember that?
Oh, the dash one.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Carter, you ready to go into it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay. Public hearing on Senate Bill.
We're moving here.
82 and open a work session on Senate Bill 480.
Mr. Chairman, I have worked with the Health Division, a representative of the American Liver Foundation, with these amendments, along with Senator Klarno's office, and these are the two vaccines that the CDC is recommending to be given to children: hepatitis A and pneumococcal conjugate. And so, with that in mind, I'd like to move the Dash One amendments and rescind. Just move the first. Okay, rescind the back. Excuse me. Thank you. Pass the Dash One amendments. Wow.
Okay. Senator Carter has moved. We passed the amendments, Dash One amendments to Senate Bill 482. Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I just appreciate the slowing the process down. I think it's a good idea. not on our process, but on the purpose of the bill and the amendments.
Yeah. I guess Senator Mesley won't have any problems with this here, being he's part of the sponsorship.
I am.
Yes, you are.
Hello. I better look at this bill. it woke me right up.
Objection? Any further discussion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I'd like to rescind the motion to send Senate Bill 42 to Ways and Means. Okay, now that I'm correct. Okay, here we go, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
I would like...
Is that right? Because I'm going to copy you.
That's right. I'd like to move Senate Bill 482 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Carter would like to move Senate Bill 482 to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation and rescind the
Ways and
referral
Means.
To the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Is there further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator
Mosley. Aye.
Senator Hill.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator
Carter.
Aye.
Senator Fisher.
Aye. Motion carries. And all right, Senator Shields volunteers, and if Senator Mesley sponsors the air, we'll
have... He has no idea what it's about
Senator
either.
Senator Shields carries a bill, and Motion passes.
Harder's been.
Work session.
Oh, it's yours.
You want to carry.
If you don't mind, I'll carry my own beer.
Well, that's the open work session. Senator Carter, I didn't even see your name. Wait. Far out front, I didn't see it.
We worked too hard. And wait a minute, you think I'm going to let my one positive action today go by? No, the boys have been against me all day. Absolutely not.
We voted wrong. Now, let's make a second. And I'm sure the boys will pay for it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 482. Glad we got the most difficult question out of the way here.
Yeah, who's to blame?
Who's going to carry Senate Bill 482?
We could surely ask the three, you know.
Hearing no and having no further items coming, I guess we had scratched Senate Bill 3145 until Friday. So have a nice evening. Thank you for your attention.
You guys hit me hard today, but I'm getting forced.
Good trip on you,
Wow.